Welcome back, everybody, to lecture two of the standard model. So in this guy, we're actually going to dive into the physics. So the next two lectures will really be about getting to know non-abelian gauge theory, also known as Yang-Mills theory, building up to defining the particular Yang-Mills theory that corresponds to the standard model. So we're going to give an introduction. I know that you have already met Yang-Mills theory to some extent, and maybe some people to different extents. So this is hopefully will be a brief but reinforcing introduction, complementary to what you've seen. Yeah, I think it probably never gets never hurts to get a little bit clearer about these things, especially because in the standard model, it's going to be an example of a Yang-Mills theory. But there's going to be a big part of getting to understand the standard model is, I mean, in a sense, in a kind of trivial sense, just understanding like who has what indices and what they all mean physically, and which indices are talking to which. And that's a very sort of pedestrian way to describe it, but it everybody finds it confusing at first, and so I think it's better to start with a reintroduction to Yang-Mills theory. And the way I'm going to do it is by analogy with general relativity. So you know, there's a sense in which if you want to derive the action for general relativity, the way that basically the way that Hilbert originally found it, versus finding the action for Yang-Mills theory, the derivations are very parallel for the most part. But then there are a couple differences at the end, and those differences are really key. They turn out to make a huge deal. They turn out to be very important in terms of both the classical physics described by those theories and then the quantum physics. And there are really those seemingly minor differences are still at the heart of what theoretical physicists are puzzling over today, and sort of how to quantize gravity in particular, and how it fits together with the rest of the standard model. So I wanted to begin with a lightning review of GR and the derivation of the action in GR. And now I know that Ruth's gravitational physics course is going on right now, and so different people will have different backgrounds in this. So for some of you, this will be a lightning review. For some of you, this will be a lightning introduction. For those of you that it's a lightning introduction, it'll be too lightning. You shouldn't expect to completely understand GR just from this two-slide introduction, but it'll hopefully give a helpful overview of the logic of the theory and the logic of deriving the action formula, the Lagrangian, I should say, from which all of the classical physics and quantum physics can be derived by either the Euler Lagrange equations for the classical physics or by the Feynman path integral for the quantum physics. Let's dive in. So this is the lightning review/intro to GR. So in GR, you know, we start with a four-dimensional space-time manifold M. Okay, this kidney bean here is supposed to be my picture of a generic four-dimensional space-time manifold. So I've drawn two examples of, you know, a four-dimensional space-time manifold just means a four-dimensional smooth surface. So you need four coordinates to tell you where you are on that surface, four real coordinates. And if you zoom in close to any point on the surface, you know, in a small region around any point on the surface, it looks a lot like four-dimensional Euclidean. It looks a lot like R4. So four-dimensional Euclidean space, if the metric has all plus signs, or in the space that we live in, it looks a lot like Minkowski space close to any point because the metric has one minus sign and three plus signs. Okay, So, and then I've drawn two representative points on the manifold here, just for illustration. Here's the point P up here, and here's the point P prime down here. And then above, right above each point in the manifold, there is a vector space, an important vector space, a tangent space. So this is the tangent. So here I've kind of schematically drawn the basis vectors for the tangent space above point P. and I've called that tangent space T sub P. So that's the space of tangent vectors to the manifold at that point. So all, basically the space of vectors that point in all the different directions along the manifold, along the surface of the kidney beam at that point. So TP is this, you know, since it's a four-dimensional manifold, the tangent space is a four-dimensional vector space. So TP is a little four-dimensional vector space living above the point P. T of P prime is another four-dimensional vector space living above the point P prime. And every point on the manifold has one of these four-dimensional vector spaces living over it. Now, if I think about not just a single vector space over a single point, but the collection of all those vector spaces over all of those points. So there's some continuous infinity of different vector spaces living over the continuous infinity of different points in the manifold. That collection of all those tangent vector spaces is called the tangent bundle. So I'll call the tangent bundle T. General relativity, boiled down to its essence, is really about this tangent bundle, and in particular, the curvature of the tangent bundle. In modern language, GR is really about the idea that what we normally call the force of gravity is really, and the effects of gravity and gravitational physics is really all about the curvature of the tangent bundle of space-time. So to understand what we mean by that, let's start by thinking about a vector V living in one of our tangent vector spaces. So let's see a vector living in T sub P here. So that's a four-dimensional vector, a tangent vector at that point. So one of the key ideas of general relativity is, you know, that the theory is supposed to be generally covariant. So what does that really mean? Well, it's basically just Einstein's idea that, you know, that it's very important that physical quantities, we should be able to describe them in terms of whatever space-time coordinates we want, and that shouldn't really affect the physics. It should just be a different description of the physics. But unless the quantity is a scalar, then the quantity may nevertheless look different in different coordinate systems, in different reference frames. For example, if we use some coordinate system x mu to describe the different positions on the to describe the different points on the manifold, then with respect to that coordinate system, the components of the vector v could have, you know, could be one set of numbers, V alpha, where alpha runs from 0, 1, 2, 3. But now if we change coordinates to a different coordinate system, x twiddle, if we use these x twiddle mu coordinates to describe the different positions on the manifold, well, then those will, the coordinate directions will be different vectors in the tangent space over point P. And so there'll be some different basis for that vector space. And so we'll just be re-expressing that same vector V in this different basis. And so the components will look different in that different basis. So in the new X prime mu coordinates, the components will be some new values, V twiddle alpha. And in particular, the relation between the new components, V twiddle alpha in the X twiddle coordinate system, and the old components in the old x mu coordinates will be linearly related by some linear transformation u alpha beta. So this is u alpha beta is a matrix. You can, throughout this lecture, the upper index you should think of as the first matrix index, the row index, and the lower index, beta, is the second index, the column index. And in particular, the linear transformation between these two bases is just given by the matrix of partial derivatives of the new coordinates x twiddle alpha with respect to the old coordinates x beta. So now a key part of general relativity is that really that coordinate transformation between x and x twiddle can be anything. And so in particular, the transformation matrix doesn't have to be the same over each point in the manifold. It can depend on the space-time coordinate. It can be a function of the space-time coordinate x. What happens is that, you know, now if we want to take a derivative of the vector field, if we have vectors, you know, a vector field, the vector v, a vector v living over point P, and then a vector v living over all the different points in spacetime, we want to take the spacetime derivative of that vector field, as we often do when building an action, or we'll run into the problem that if we just take the ordinary partial derivative of that, d mu of v alpha, that it doesn't transform like a tensor. It isn't a tensor. So I should clarify here that when I say d partial sub mu here, that's shorthand notation. That partial sub mu is shorthand for the operator partial x mu. So it's the partial derivative along the mu direction. So it isn't a tensor because, you know, if I imagine taking this object, if I take v alpha here and transform it to v prime alpha, so v prime alpha is uv, since u and v both depend on x, when I take the partial derivative and I use the Leibniz rule, that splits into two terms, the first term where the partial acts on u and doesn't act on v, and a second term where it passes through u and just acts on v. A sum of two terms is not what you want for a tensor. Okay, so it doesn't behave like a tensor, and so we want to correct that transformation. And so the trick is that we introduce a new derivative operator, the covariant derivative, which I've written here as nabla sub mu. And the idea is that, we saw that the first term here, the covariant derivative is equal to the partial derivative, but then it's plus a correction term. And the correction term here is the product of gamma alpha mu beta, which is called the connection on the tangent bundle, or the Levi-Civita connection in particular, and then physicists call it the Christoffel symbol, times v beta. So in other words, what this is saying is that the covariant derivative is, if I want to take the covariant derivative along some coordinate direction mu, I take the partial derivative along that direction, but then I add to that. So if I fix mu, then gamma mu is a matrix with indices alpha and beta, and that matrix is performing a little extra rotation that I'm adding to the partial derivative. So the connection sort of corrects the partial derivative by a little extra rotation. And the idea then is that, the problem was that this original term didn't transform like a tensor. And what we do is we just require that this second term also not transform like a tensor. We figure out how alpha mu beta has to transform, so that instead of transforming like a tensor, it doesn't transform like a tensor, but the non-tensorial part of this term exactly cancels the non-tensorial part of this term. And so the sum of the two does become a tensor. So I won't do it here. I'll do the exactly analogous calculation for the Yang-Mills connection in a moment. But when you take a GR class, you know that at the start you do this exercise, and I recommend doing it or reviewing it if you haven't done it recently, of figuring out how gamma mu alpha beta has to transform under a coordinate transformation in order to ensure that V mu alpha is a tensor. So as I say, we'll get to the analogous calculation and formula for the gauge field in a moment. But for now, I just want to say that in terms of the logic of how the theory proceeds, then one next notes that, okay, we'd like to build the simplest non-trivial tensor we can on the manifold involving derivatives of the metric. And that is done by noting that now, if we take the commutator of two covariant derivatives, one along the mu direction and one along the nu direction, so mu nu minus nu mu, commutator, acting on some vector v, that no longer vanishes. So in other words, normally with the partial derivatives, you know, two partial derivatives acting on a function, commute. But not so with covariant derivatives. Instead, they give a non-zero answer. And since we've designed the left-hand side of this equation to be a tensor, the right-hand side has to be a tensor too, and it turns out to be a tensorial quantity that's proportional to it's linear in the vector we're differentiating, and then the coefficients have to themselves be a tensor for the right-hand side to be a tensor, and that tensor is a famous tensor. It's called the Riemann curvature tensor. So, you know, if you look at this tensor, you know, its indices are forced in order to make the two sides of this equation make sense, have the same indices, you know. So we have to, the left-hand side of the equation has two lower indices mu and nu and one upper index alpha, and then the right-hand side of the equation has to have this one quantity with an upper index v beta. So R has to have a lower index beta to contract with this upper index beta to get rid of it, basically to eat it. And then its additional indices have to match whatever is on, its additional free indices have to match whatever is on the left-hand side. So it has to have these additional indices, mu, nu, and alpha. So this identity, this fact that the commutator of two covariant derivatives does not vanish, but instead is proportional to a tensor, the curvature tensor times the vector we're differentiating. That's called the Ricci identity. And in particular, when you look at the Ricci identity on the tangent bundle, you get a famous formula. If you just plug in the above expression, this expression for the covariant derivative, if you plug that in to the covariant derivatives down here and evaluate the left-hand side of this expression, then you'll see that the Ricci identity implies a famous formula for this Riemann curvature tensor. And I haven't written it out explicitly here. I've suppressed all the indices because the details are not crucial here. We're going to do in a moment the analogous calculation for the Yang-Mills field. But if you've taken a GR course, you've seen this formula. It's the famous formula for how to calculate the Riemann curvature tensor from the Christoffel symbols. It's sort of two terms that are like partial gamma and partial gamma, and then two terms that are like gamma times gamma and gamma times gamma. Okay, so now we want to build an action. So we're trying to find, you know, let's say Hilbert was trying to find the simplest scalar quantity he could write down. So Hilbert had learned from Einstein that the idea was to try to write down a theory that was coordinate invariant. So a coordinate invariant in this language of tensors is a scalar. It's an object with no free indices, so it doesn't transform under coordinate transformations. And so he understood that the idea was that he wanted to find a Lagrangian for the theory that was coordinate invariant, because then that would give rise to a theory where coordinate invariance was a symmetry of the theory, which is what Einstein had figured out was needed. And so what can we do? Well, we have our simplest tensor, the Riemann tensor. How can we build a scalar quantity out of it? So far it has four indices hanging around, so that's not yet what we want. We want the Lagrangian to be a scalar. So the simplest possibility is that, well, if we look at our four index object, we can just contract one of the upper indices with one of the lower indices. It turns out if we tried to contract alpha with beta, that would give zero because of the symmetry of the tensor. So we can't do that. It turns out to not really matter. It's just a matter of convention. It turns out to be equivalent whether we contract with the second or third lower index mu or nu. So conventionally, we contract alpha and mu. So I've just contracted them by multiplying here by a Dirac, by a Kronecker delta function, d mu alpha. So this mu soaks up this mu, and this alpha soaks up this alpha. So it basically just sets those two indices equal and sums them. Oh, I should have said something. Sorry. Hopefully you've all seen this, but I have been using since this line, I think, the Einstein summation convention, which is this, you know, convention where if I have a product of two tensors and they share a common index like this, these two in this product, gamma and v both have the index beta, but one is up and one is down. That always means that I'm supposed to sum those two indices over their whole range. So in this case, these are space-time indices, so I'm summing them over 0, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so similarly here. So this is just being pedantic about how to actually force those two indices to be equal and then sum them. I multiply by this Kronecker delta. And so once I've done that, I've soaked up the alpha and mu indices. The leftover indices are beta and nu. So I have a new tensor, which only has two indices, beta and nu. That's another famous tensor called the Ricci tensor, sort of a subset of the terms in the Riemann tensor. So I'm not there yet. I still have indices I need to get rid of. So can I get rid of those? Well, yes. In GR, you can, because one of the objects at your disposal is the metric. You can use the inverse metric, which has two upper indices. You can contract those two upper indices with the two lower indices of the Ricci tensor, and now there are no free indices left. So you have a scalar called the Ricci scalar. So far, so good. We have the simplest scalar we can think of. The simplest non-trivial scalar we can build. And then the only thing left is that the Ricci scalar does not have the right action, does not have the right units to be a Lagrangian. A Lagrangian has to have the right, has to have units so that when you integrate it over space-time, you get the action, and the action has units of h bar. So anyway, we'll discuss units more in the future, but for now, you know, just we don't have the right units, so we have to add a coefficient in front in order to convert the Ricci scalar into something that has the units of an action. So we have to add some dimensionful coefficient in front with the right dimensions to do that, and that coefficient has a name. It's 1 over 16 pi g Newton. It turns out to be nothing but the Newton's constant of gravity. Or 1 over 16 pi times Newton's constant for gravity. Okay, and presto, we've derived the action for general relativity. You know, this is essentially what Hilbert did, and to the best that we can tell experimentally today, it works. So great. So for GR, this line of reasoning was terrific. Okay, so let's try to do the same thing for Yang-Mills theory. So for Yang-Mills, well, we go back to our original picture from before. We have our space-time manifold, And we have our point P and our point P prime. And previously we were talking in GR about the tangent vector space TP and TP prime living over each point in the manifold. And now the key difference between GR and Yang-Mills theory is that instead of thinking about the tangent space, we're going to think about a different abstract vector space above each point in the manifold. And instead of, whereas GR was about the curvature of the tangent bundle, Yang-Mills theory is going to be all about the curvature of this other abstract vector bundle. Okay, so I want to replace TP. Instead of TP, I'm going to think about a different abstract n-dimensional vector space V sub P. Okay, so let's say the space-time dimension is D, or 4, D was 4. And so T sub P was a D-dimensional or a four-dimensional vector space, but V sub P could be any other number that we want, whatever, it depends on what Yang-Mills theory we want to consider. For the standard model, V sub P will be, as far as we can tell, either a 45 or a 48-dimensional vector space. So for the time being, it's some other vector space. And similarly over P prime, we have another vector space V sub P, which has the same dimension. And again, so each vector space V sub P or V sub P prime is a finite dimensional vector space. But now we can consider the collection of all of those vector spaces, the ones living over each of the continuum of points on the manifold. And together, those form the vector bundle V. So the tangent bundle was a specific example of a vector bundle. It was the specific example where the vector space above each point is the four-dimensional tangent space. But now we're going to consider a more general vector bundle. Okay, good. So let's consider a vector in one of in the vector space V sub P. So this is a vector in the vector space V sub P. So in the standard model, this would be a 45 component vector of 45 complex numbers. So that's the vector living above the point P. Oh, I should say, And if I label the point P by coordinates X, if I take space-time coordinates X on the manifold, so now instead of just considering, the vector above a given point in the manifold, again, I'm going to now consider the vector field, the collection of a vector above this point, a vector above this point, a vector above this point, et cetera, one vector above each point in the manifold. So a vector field. Mathematicians would call that thing, physicists would call that the vector field psi alpha of X. Mathematicians would call that a section of this vector bundle V. And that section of the vector bundle V, well, that is what a matter field will, that is what the matter field will be in the standard model. That will be this 45 component guy that I'm talking about. This field that has a 45 is whose value above each point in space is a 45 component vector. That is the matter field of all the spinners, of all the spinorial, all the fermion fields in the standard model. So that's what the matter fields are. So as I say here, Yang-Mills theory is all about the curvature of this vector bundle and how it interacts with the matter fields that live in that vector bundle, that are sections of that vector bundle. So let's just look now at the analogy of the logic between GR and Yang-Mills. So in GR, we considered a vector in the tangent space above point P. In Yang-Mills, we're going to consider a matter field whose value above each point space time is a vector in some other vector, abstract vector space above point P. In GR, the key idea was that when we changed coordinates the components in a new coordinate system were related to the components in the old coordinate system by a transformation matrix. And that transformation matrix was given by this particular expression involving the partials of the old coordinate system with respect to the new coordinates with respect to the old. Okay, so now in this case, well, this index alpha, this index A is no longer a space-time index. So the transformation matrix can't be the same matrix anymore. It's somehow not about, it can't be about space-time coordinates. This vector doesn't point along any direction in space-time or anything like that. Instead, the transformation will be given by a matrix U that is an element of some other group G that we choose, and which will be called the gauge group of this Yang-Mills theory. So, for example, in the standard model, we have learned from experiments that the standard model is a particular Yang-Mills theory whose gauge group is the group SU3 times SU2 times U1. But in principle, we could pick any group we wanted here and define a corresponding Yang-Mills theory. And so, whereas GR was about finding a theory that was invariant under coordinate transformations, Yang-Mills theory is about finding a theory that is invariant, constructing a Lagrangian that is invariant under these gauge transformations, transformations of the matter fields by this by matrices drawn from this other group, the gauge group. Okay, and then just as in GR, we noticed that since the transformation matrix U can depend on the space-time point, the partial derivative of the vector V is not a tensor. Similarly, over here, the derivative of psi will not be a tensor if I like to scribble on the things I'm talking about, and then sometimes I need to talk about them so many times I need to, you know, scribble over my previous scribbles, and so it's I have a scribbling problem. I don't know, you guys are the victims of my scribbling problem. So in fact, you know, when physicists say that something is a gauge transformation, you know, in modern parlance, they usually essentially mean precisely that the transformation matrix that appears in the theory is a function of the space-time coordinate, isn't a constant in space-time. And so that's what we want to allow this matrix U to be. And so this transformation from psi to psi twiddle, isn't going to be a tensor because, well, when we take the derivative here again and act with the Leibniz rule, we'll get two terms. There's the one term that we want where the derivative passes through U and we get U times partial mu of psi. But there's the other term which we don't want, which is where the partial acts on U itself because it depends on space-time. That's the non-tensorial part of the transformation law. So that's what I say here. This second term is the non-tensorial part. And so as before, the solution is that we introduce a covariant derivative. GR, we introduced a covariant derivative nabla mu, which was the partial mu, the original partial derivative, plus an extra term which involved a connection which we called gamma and called physicists call the Christoffel symbol, mathematicians call the Levi-Civita connection. It's the connection on the tangent bundle. In Yang-Mills theory, we analogously introduce a covariant derivative to fix the analogous problem. Usually we call it capital D mu now. And again, once again, it's the ordinary partial derivative plus an extra piece, which again has the same basic structure. You see the same, here the connection had indices, one space-time index corresponding to the direction along which we're differentiating on the manifold, And then two more indices, which in GR were also space-time indices. But now in Yang-Mills, the connection, well, again, we have our space-time index here corresponding to the direction we're differentiating along. But the other two indices, A and B, are no longer, they're supposed to perform this little extra rotation to correct the derivative. But now we're not, you know, rotating in the tangent space. So the indices for that rotation matrix, A and B, should not be space-time indices. They're the gauge indices, A and B, I should say. Hopefully it's clear, but I'm using this convention where you know, Greek indices are, I'm using them as space-time indices, and that run from 0, 1, 2, 3, and Latin indices like A and B are gauge indices. Okay, and so physicists call this guy the Yang-Mills gauge field, or the connection on this vector bundle that the matter field lives in. Okay, and so then we figure out, just like we figured out how gamma transforms, by demanding that it transforms in such a way that the covariant derivative of V alpha is a tensor. Similarly, we figure out how A should transform under a gauge transformation so that the covariant derivative of psi, d mu of psi, transforms as a tensor under gauge transformations. So, Okay, so let's pause for a moment to see. This is a very good exercise that I recommend working out on your own. I just sketch it here. So how does A have to transform in order for the covariant derivative to be a tensor? So in other words, here is what we want. So we have this covariant derivative of the matter field, d mu of psi A. Now, we want it to be a tensor. Well, first of all, what do we mean? It looks like this thing has two indices, mu and A, but in Yang-Mills theory, we're focusing on gauge transformation. So we can imagine doing a gauge transformation without doing a coordinate transformation for the moment. And therefore we don't have to, the space-time index mu is irrelevant. We don't have to pay attention to it at the moment. So in the sense that we're talking about at the moment, this is a one index object. It's a vector with one gauge index A. And so to transform like a tensor, what we mean is that under a transformation, it should transform to a new transformed quantity, twiddled quantity. So we have d twiddle times psi twiddle, and that should be equal to the old quantity times one copy of the gauge transformation matrix, because that's how a vector transforms. A vector with one index, one upper index, transforms with one copy of the transformation matrix if it's a tensor. So it should transform, it should be the old quantity times one u. Okay, so then if we just expand out, now in the next line, I've just written the same expression, but I have just suppressed the indices A and B and written it in ordinary matrix notation. So this is now a vector, but I just haven't written its vector index explicitly. This is a matrix. I haven't written its matrix indices explicitly, acting on a vector whose indices I haven't written explicitly. This is a part of the general process of learning the standard model, is that there's a lot of indices keeping track of, because there's three different parts of the gauge group. Each of those have different indices, and then there's space-time indices and spinner indices. There's a lot of indices floating around, and it can be a mess if you keep them all, and it can be very confusing to know which is contracted with which. And so it tends to be the case that at the beginning, you want to sort of make sure you write things out explicitly with all the indices. So you really make sure what's going on, which indices are talking to who's contracted with what. But as soon as possible, you want to try to learn to suppress the indices and write it in matrix notation, which is unambiguous, but you know, only after you get used to the rules for how Only after you get it's unambiguous but confusing until you get used to the indices. So at several stages here, when something is at risk of being confusing, I'm going to write out all the indices. But then, as soon as possible, I'm going to try to suppress them again to make our lives easier and have easier expressions to look at. But yeah, I do recommend in terms of making sure you understand what's going on here, going back and looking at some of these expressions and trying to see if you can put the indices back in where they belong and really know where they go. Okay, so in other words, we want this equation to be true, where psi twiddle is equal to u psi. That's how psi transforms under a gauge transformation, and where capital D is equal to partial plus A. That's the equation for the covariant derivative. And where capital D twiddle is equal to partial plus A twiddle, the transformed covariant derivative. And so, you know, the exercise that I recommend is that take these three expressions for psi twiddle, D, and D twiddle, you know, plug them in to this previous equation and simplify, solve for A twiddle, and see. Find the result here for how A twiddle has to transform in order for this equation to be true. And you'll find that when you isolate A twiddle on one side of the equation and everything else on the other side, you get an equation like this, that A twiddle has to be equal to UAU inverse. So that's how A would transform if it was a tensor. But then there's this extra non-tensorial piece, which can be written as either minus partial mu of u times u inverse, or equivalently plus u of partial mu of u inverse. Those turn out to be equal to each other because u times u inverse is equal to one, equal to the identity matrix, which is a constant. And so the partial acting on the constant is zero. So that's how you can rewrite the first expression as the second expression. Or again, if I wanted to explicitly display the indices here, I won't explicitly go through this, but again, as part of the exercise, I really recommend that you make sure that you understand how to put the indices back in to go from this expression up here to this expression down here. Okay, good. So let's go back. So now we're back at our previous analogy. So we've already discussed this slide down to here. So now we've introduced on both sides in GR and in Yang-Mills theory, we've introduced a covariant derivative. And remember, the next step in GR was that we noticed that the covariant derivative, if we took that expression and calculated the commutator of two covariant derivatives, it wasn't zero. Instead, when it acted on a vector, it was equal to some non-zero expression proportional to a new tensor, the Riemann tensor, a curvature tensor. And by plugging in the expression for the covariant derivative, we get our expression for the Riemann tensor in terms of the connection gamma on the tangent bundle. So in Yang-Mills theory, we do the exactly analogous thing. We again notice that the commutator of two covariant derivatives does not commute anymore. That's not zero when we act it on a vector. Instead, it's equal to a non-zero expression, and the coefficients in that expression form a new tensor. Now, if you match up the indices on both sides of the expression, you'll see that the indices on this tensor, it no longer has four space-time indices. It has four indices still, but two of them are the space-time indices mu and nu, corresponding to the two directions along which we differentiate. But the other two correspond to two gauge indices. So for each fixed point in the manifold, above each fixed point in the manifold, and for fixed values of the two space-time derivative directions mu and nu, the value of this curvature tensor is a matrix with indices A and B that's acting on the vector psi B. And again, if we just take the above expression for the covariant derivative, with the indices suppressed now again, and plug it in here, we get an expression analogous to the expression for the Riemann curvature. We get an expression for the gauge curvature f mu nu, which is partial mu of a nu minus partial nu of A mu plus the commutator of A mu with A nu. On the left-hand side, remember, I had been very schematic about writing this expression. I had suppressed all of the indices, so the expression does not yet really make sense as I've written it here. On the other hand, this expression is really the correct expression. It's just that I've written it in matrix notation, like I described above, in the matrix notation where I suppress the gauge indices, the Latin indices. So in other words, if you think about these expressions, again, if I suppress the gauge indices A and B here, F is F mu nu. But again, secretly, F is a matrix above each point in spacetime, if I think in terms of the gauge space. Okay, so the left-hand side of this expression is a matrix with respect to the gauge indices. A mu is also a matrix with respect to the gauge indices. So this guy is also a matrix, as is this guy. And then these guys are both matrices with respect to the gauge indices. And when I say the commutator, I mean the matrix commutator in that sense with respect to those gauge indices. So this is matrix multiplication, where I'm interpreting these guys as matrices in the gauge space in terms of they have two. I think of them as you know, matrices are objects with two indices. Those are the two gauge indices on A and A mu and A nu that I've suppressed here. So anyway, as I say, undoubtedly I'm confusing some of you with this, but I think there's no remedy but to puzzle over it and make sure you know how to take the indices in and out until you're clear what's going on here. In the GR case, this object is called the Riemann curvature. In the Yang-Mills case, physicists would call this the Yang-Mills field strength, or the mathematicians would call it the curvature of this vector bundle. Notice that we've been talking so far about non-abelian gauge theory, where the gauge group G is a non-abelian group. In other words, elements of that group don't commute with each other. So little g1 times little g2 is not equal in general to little g2 times little g1. So the group is non-commutative or non-abelian. However, we could do the exactly analogous construction for an abelian group, where the gauge group capital G is an abelian group like U1, the group of points on the unit circle in the complex plane e to the I alpha. And in that case, all of this story would reduce to the derivation of electromagnetism. So this in that case, A mu would be nothing but the usual photon field, the gauge field of electromagnetism, and F mu nu would be nothing but the field strength of electromagnetism. So the field strength of electromagnetism is really nothing but the curvature of the U1 gauge bundle over spacetime. Okay, fine. So now we're at the last step here, where we try to construct the action. So in GR, the story was very simple. We had constructed the Riemann curvature tensor with four indices. Well,
excuse me.
Yes.
Is there a similar notion to metric in the Yang-Mills theory?
Excellent question. So I'm about to discuss that right now. That's exactly where the difference will appear, and that's going to be key on this slide. So just give me one moment. So if you think about what we did in the we had built, so far the analogy has gone great. We built a curvature tensor with four indices in the GR case, and we built a closely analogous curvature tensor with four indices in the Yang-Mills case. But now the next two steps depend crucially on the fact that in the In the GR case, the next two steps depended crucially on the fact that all four indices on the curvature tensor were space-time indices. So in particular, we could contract the upper index with the lower indices, the lower index, because there were two indices of the same type. And then we were left with two more indices, which again were of the same type, and we could use the metric, the inverse metric, to contract those two. And so in that way, we were able to construct an invariant, the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, the Lagrangian for GR, which was linear in the curvature tensor. So what happens when we try to do the analogous thing in Yang-Mills? So the first thing to say is that now the Lagrangian that we're trying to construct, again, we're trying to find the simplest scalar we can, but now it has to be a scalar in two different ways. Now, once again, it has to be coordinate invariant, Lorentz invariant. So we have to make sure we have an object which doesn't have any leftover space-time indices. We want all the space-time indices to be contracted up, so we have a space-time scalar. But now we also demand, as the sort of basic principle of Yang-Mills theory, that also it has to be a scalar under gauge transformation. So we have to build an object that doesn't have any free gauge indices hanging around. All the gauge indices are also contracted up with one another. Okay, so we run into problems then with step one, because so we have our curvature tensor, but now the analogous thing would be to try to contract A with mu here. But you know, the problem is A and mu are two completely different types of indices. You know, one's a space-time index that runs from 0 to 3, and the other one is a completely abstract internal index which runs from 1 to 45. And so there's no, you know, it just doesn't make sense to write down a Kronecker delta there to contract them. That's a nonsensical expression. So we can't do that. Okay, so we've run into a hitch in the analogy. So what do we do instead? The next simplest thing we do is we can note that f mu nu transforms like a tensor. Okay, on the previous slide, we had worked out how there was an exercise where you worked out how A transforms, and A does not transform like a tensor. Okay, but then on the next slide, you worked out what F was in terms of A. So F is given in terms of A by this expression here. And now another important exercise here is to check that F, therefore, given how A transforms and given how F depends on A, F is a tensor. It transforms just like U, F mu nu, U inverse, completely linearly with two factors of U and U inverse corresponding to the fact that F has one up and one downstairs gauge index. So therefore, we can form a nice coordinate scalar by just contracting F mu nu lower with two lower indices with F mu nu with two upper indices, just like we do in making the Lagrangian in electromagnetism. You know, because we have for the space-time indices, we have a nice space-time metric we can raise and lower them with, so we can contract those indices using the space-time metric, g mu nu or eta mu nu. Now this thing is a coordinate scalar because all the coordinate indices have been contracted up, but it's not a gauge invariant scalar yet. Because again, if you check from the previous formula, you'll see that this expression now transforms like U, F mu nu, U inverse. So it again transforms like a tensor. So the last step is, again, I leave as an exercise, convince, make sure you understand why this is true. If I now take the trace, so again, this F, remember, if I think of it as a matrix in gauge space, it has two gauge indices. So if I think of it as a matrix in gauge space, then F times F is another matrix. So this whole thing is a matrix in gauge space. I can take the trace of that matrix. And that thing, now when I look at how that transforms, the U's also disappear and it just transforms into itself. So this is a scalar under both coordinate transformations and gauge transformations. So there we go, we've done it. We've written down the simplest scalar we can that's both Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant. And now the only thing left is to check, does it have the right units to be the Lagrangian? Well, yes, it does. So now we can still write down a coefficient in front, but that coefficient should now be dimensionless, not spoil the units. And that coefficient is conventionally called 1 over 4g squared, where g now is called the gauge coupling of that Yang-Mills theory. Bigger values of g basically mean that the force carried by the gauge field A mu, the Yang-Mills gauge field A mu, is stronger. So g measures how strong the force is. And so there we go. That's the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. It's not quite as simple as the GR Lagrangian, but it's the next simplest thing. It's quadratic. However, the interesting thing is even though the stories were so parallel, and even though it seems like the GR derivation was maybe a little bit simpler than the Yang-Mills derivation, you know, actually, this theory really, in some sense, turns out to be much more puzzling than this theory. And these small differences end up making a huge difference in terms of the physics. You know, classically speaking, this theory has black hole solutions. This theory doesn't have anything like that. And then quantum mechanically, this theory is as well defined a quantum field theory as we know of. It's renormalizable. To the extent that there is a well-defined quantum field theory, this guy is a well-defined quantum field theory. On the other hand, famously, this is a non-renormalizable quantum field theory and is very mysterious, really. No one really knows what the right way is to quantize this theory. And that's a famous open problem, what is the right theory of quantum gravity? And so, yeah, they're very closely parallel. The small differences somehow have big implications, and we're still wrestling with those. So, okay, let me stop there. I'm not 10 minutes early. I had hoped to be. Anyway, at least I'm not late. Anyway, are there any questions about that?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how we can think about having different indices in Yang-Mills theories, like space-time indices and gauge indices, differently in a geometrical way? What is the picture
Geometrically, I do think of all of these indices. I do think of this whole story as being geometrical, but you know, it's not geometry. It's not purely about geometry in space-time in the Yang-Mills case. You have to think of, you know, it's like it's exactly analogous to, you know, there, you know, you encounter symmetries, you know, there's Noether's theorem. Noether made this amazing discovery that you know, all of the conserved quantities in physics correspond to symmetries of the Lagrangian describing whatever physics you're looking at. But those symmetries can come in two types. There can be space-time symmetries, like you know, the Lagrangian could be invariant under translations, or it could be invariant under rotations, and those lead to conserved quantities like conservation of momentum or conservation of angular momentum. But then there can be internal symmetries where you don't move anything around in space-time, but at each point in space-time, you just take the fields living above that point in space-time and you mix them up with each other or you rotate them by a phase or something. So the conserved charge in electromagnetism is that sort of internal symmetry. You know, it's that's the consequence of the fact that E&M is the abelian analog of what we've been talking about. It's the case where the matter fields transform like under the abelian group U1, so the electron field above each point in space can transform to e to the I phi times the electron field, where e to the I phi, where phi can be a function of space time that varies over space time, and the Lagrangian for electromagnetism and its interaction with the electron field is invariant under that. So Noether's theorem says that also gives a conserved quantity. That's the electric charge, but it doesn't have a space-time interpretation, but it nevertheless has a. So this is geometrical in the sense that it's still about vectors rotating in some vector space, and but it's not. But those vectors do not point in any direction in space-time, and so they're not geometrical in that sense. Is that a So to say another possibly helpful thing about how it's geometrical, you know, you may have learned in GR, or you will learn, and if you haven't, that, you know, what the one geometrical consequence of the Riemann curvature, the curvature of the tangent bundle, is that if you take a vector in the tangent bundle, like a momentum vector, if you take the momentum of a particle, and then you imagine parallel transporting that vector around a small closed loop, you know, if you were in flat space, when you parallel transport a vector around a closed loop, it comes back to itself. But in curved space, if you go around a closed loop, it comes back to a slightly different vector, where the difference depends on the integral of the curvature around that, depends on the curvature enclosed by that loop. So very analogously, if you take a vector in this internal space, you can also, there's also a notion of parallel transporting it. Well, what does parallel transport mean? It means in the GR case, parallel transport means I move the vector in such a way that the covariant GR derivative acting on that vector is zero as I move it along a curve. So in the Yang-Mills case, if I take a vector now in this abstract space V, I can still define parallel transport of that vector as I move it to different vector spaces over the manifold, where now it means that the covariant derivative capital D, the gauge covariant derivative acting on that vector, is equal to zero as I move it around. And now, again, if I take if I parallel transport it in that sense around a closed loop, I find that depending on how much curvature is enclosed by that loop, where now the curvature is F, the Yang-Mills curvature, the vector will not come back to itself, but will be shifted by an amount that depends on the curvature enclosed by the loop.
Thank you. So adding this local, like local kind of symmetries in Yang-Mills theories, this is the thing that's helping us to like not having singularities that we can have like in GR. Like how to think about that? Like why do we have singularities in the case that we only are working with like coordinate symmetries and space-time translation, but we're not running to any similar singularity in Yang-Mills theories? Like why should it be the case?
That question is too deep. I don't think I have a great answer to that. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that it's the case that you don't have singular solutions or singularities don't form in Yang-Mills. I think maybe they do. So it's not that GR forms singularities and that Yang-Mills doesn't. GR forms black holes, which have to do with, they not only have a singularity, but that's surrounded by an event horizon. And that comes from the fact that the metric, that the variable there in that theory is the metric, which has light-like directions, which has a light cones, which the Yang-Mills theory doesn't have an analog of that, because the metric is in this split, lives in this space of split signature where there's three space directions and one time direction, you know, whereas the Yang-Mills takes place in a, you know, UN is like a complex vector space that has only positive, you know, the norm of any vector in that, of any matter field with respect to the inner product preserved by UN is a positive definite quantity. So it doesn't have light cones in that sense. So maybe that's more the reason that for that difference. That's probably the best answer I know how to give to that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Would we formulate GR instead of as like when we think of a field theory, we write a Lagrangian and we think the Lagrangian as a function of some fields and derivatives of the fields. When we do Yang-Mills, we are thinking of like pure Yang-Mills, we would be thinking of the gluon field and the curvature is somehow derivatives of that field. But in GR, we normally think that the dynamical object is the metric and not the Levi-Civita connection. Is there a way of understanding GR in terms of the connection instead of the metric?
That's a good question also. There's two different ways to formulate GR. The way that it was originally formulated by Einstein and Hilbert was to... So once you have a metric on the manifold, so let's say you didn't have a metric on the manifold. Suppose you just had a manifold and you had this, you can first, before you introduce any metric into the story, you can have a manifold. It can have, it has tangent spaces living above each point, and you can define a connection on those tangent spaces, and you can define a curvature, all this stuff. But then you see that to actually write down the action, to write down the Lagrangian and the action, we did need the standard GR action. We did need a metric as well. So we introduce a metric, fine, and we can write down the action. And so far, I haven't said anything about the relation between the connection and the metric, You can just take that action and start by assuming there is no connection between the, no a priori connection between the metric and the connection. Gamma and G are just completely independent quantities. And then you can derive the equations of motion from that action by calculating the Euler-Lagrange equations separately for gamma. You vary the action with respect to gamma and get one equation of motion, and vary the action with respect to G and get another equation of motion. That is called the second order approach to GR, or the Palatini approach to GR. And it's beautiful because when you vary the action with respect to G, you get the usual Einstein equation that R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R is equal to zero, or when you add a matter Lagrangian is equal to T mu nu. But when you vary with respect to gamma, you get the usual expression for the Christoffel symbol gamma in terms of the metric little g. So there's this famous expression you may have seen if you, depending on how much GR you've taken, for how to calculate capital gamma from little g. So that emerges in that second order approach as an equation of motion, which is very nice. So you don't assume any a priori connection, but you derive the connection between the metric and the connection as an equation of motion from the action. That's not how Einstein and Hilbert originally did it. They had a different argument. Their argument was that if you have a metric on your manifold, then although in principle the connection could be many different things, there is a special connection that is the most natural one, called the Levi-Civita connection, which is given by the famous formula for capital G, for the Christoffel symbol capital gamma in terms of little g. So that their way of deriving that was to say, we're going to assume that the connection is this special Levi-Civita connection, which has two properties. It has zero torsion, and it has and it's metric compatible, meaning that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. That turns out to uniquely define the connection and give the standard formula in that more axiomatic way, rather than as an equation of motion. There's two different equivalent ways to approach the logic of GR. And in a sense, the latter second order one is probably the more elegant modern way. And it's more makes the parallel with Yang-Mills theory more explicit, because then in both cases, the connections are treated as independent variables in the action. But in GR, the difference is that you have yet another independent variable, the metric, which allows you to write down this linear formula for the action, as opposed to Yang-Mills, where you only have the connection to work with, so you have to write down a quadratic formula for the action.
And in the second case, you would be thinking of a gauge group that would be like the isometries of the space as the gauge group, or?
In GR, do you mean, or in Yang-Mills?
In GR.
In GR, that's a good question too. So just like there is a distinction between, you know, gauge symmetries, which are local symmetries where the symmetry parameter can vary from point to point on the space-time manifold, and global symmetries where the parameter is a constant in space-time. that is a now the kind of analog of that in GR are coordinate transformations are a gauge symmetry, because you can take an arbitrary, you can go between two arbitrary coordinate systems. And so, like we saw, the matrix, the transformation matrix U can be a function of space-time. So that's a gauge symmetry. Isometries are more like a type of global symmetry in GR on certain backgrounds. So you know, most metrics just have no isometries, but certain special metrics, like the metric on a round sphere, or the metric of Minkowski space, or the metric in Euclidean space, or they have a bunch of, they're special, they are more symmetric than the normal metric, so they have killing vectors, and those killing vectors are the generators of a group or Lie algebra, which exponentiates to a group, which is the isometry group. But that is a finite dimensional group. It's not like this infinite dimensional group of possible coordinate transformations. It's a finite group. So it's basically a global symmetry. So GR sort of doesn't have that global symmetry, period. But if you consider the physics on certain special metrics, on certain special manifolds with particular symmetric metrics, then it has that symmetry.
What does physically mean when the curvature of Young-Mills bundle is zero?
It means that the force is zero. So the F mu nu is the, just like in, so F mu nu, you should really think of as, this whole story is supposed to, Yang, so, you know, when, nobody knew that electromagnetism was a gauge theory until the 1920s, when Weyl had this sort of brilliant insight of rethinking about it in this language. But so ever since then, you know, physicists didn't really think this way until later, but Weyl understood that the gauge field was a connection and the force and F was a curvature. But it's also, of course, just the same thing. It also is the thing that Maxwell thought it was, which was a force field. You know, it's a collection of the electric and magnetic fields. And so then Yang and Mills in the 50s were trying to generalize electromagnetism to the case where the gauge group can be non-abelian. So instead of being described by a 1x1 matrix, the phase E to the I phi, it can be a 2x2 matrix, an SU2 matrix, or an SU3 matrix, or an O5 matrix, or whatever. But nevertheless, it's still the basic physical interpretation remains true that A mu is like the generalization of the photon. It's the gauge field that sort of carries the force, and F mu nu describes the actual force. So F mu nu in the case, so for example, if G was the group SU3, then the corresponding Yang-Mills theory would be basically quantum chromodynamics, and F mu nu would be a 3x3 matrix for each fixed value of mu and nu and it, above each point in space-time. And that matrix would be the value of the color, the strong force analog, or the color analog of the electric fields and the magnetic fields. And so if it's zero, it's saying there's no physical force being exerted by the gluons on some colored particle passing through that region.
Can I ask another question? Why don't we have to account for gauge invariance in GR? Like, why aren't there local symmetries that we have to account for in the same way we did for the Yang-Mills theory?
You know, in a sense, what we now maybe the best way to explain that is to say, you know, historically it's a little bit the other way around, that you know, nowadays what we think is that there are all these symmetries and the real action for nature has to satisfy all of them. So you know, the full action for nature has to be coordinate invariant, or you know, what mathematicians would call diffeomorphism invariant, which is Einstein's generally covariant, makes which is general covariance, but the it also has to be invariant under these other internal symmetries, which were in a sense only discovered later, although electromagnetism had actually been discovered before GR, but it just hadn't been interpreted this way until Weyl interpreted it that way in the 1920s. But each of these symmetries, each of these different gauge symmetries corresponds to a different gauge field, and those gauge fields carry forces that have different names. So the modern interpretation is that actually the Lagrangian has to be invariant under four symmetry groups: the diffeomorphism group, the SU3 group, the SU2 group, and the U1 group. Those are four different gauge groups, and each of them has gauge fields associated with them, and those gauge fields are have names. They are the gauge fields of the gravitational force, the strong force, the well, the last two are usually referred to together as the electroweak force, but you could say the weak force and the hypercharge force. And then the electromagnetism is now understood to be some piece of the last two groups, SU2 and U1, as we'll explain later. But so it's more that way. It's more that we think they have all four symmetry groups are now understood to be symmetries of nature. And we now understand the four forces of nature as names for the forces, the physical impacts of the presence of those corresponding gauge fields for those four corresponding gauge symmetries.
Wouldn't that mean that the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian isn't really valid in that idea of having to satisfy all four constraints or all four, you know, invariances?
Yeah, it's not the full story now, we know exactly. So it is still, like we'll see, it is still one of the terms in the Lagrangian. So it's still invariant on its own because the metric, maybe I should have said this. So, you know, the metric, another way to say the fact that Einstein got the right answer even before, okay, you could say it this way. Why did Einstein get the right answer even before we knew about these other Yang-Mills symmetries? Well, the answer is he was working with a quantity that didn't carry any of these Yang-Mills indices. The metric and the connection on space-time have space-time indices, but they just don't have, they're already scalars under the Yang-Mills symmetries. So you didn't have to know about, in order to write down the correct terms purely built, as long as you were building terms purely from the metric and the connection, you could build them without having to know anything about Yang-Mills symmetry because the quantities your building blocks were already invariant under Yang-Mills symmetry because they just don't carry any indices of that sort. Whereas once you get to a quark field, well, it has a bunch of different indices. And if you don't take account of all of those indices, including SU2 and U1 and SU3 indices, in addition to its space-time index. And so if you try to build an action and you sort of only took account of the space-time indices, you wouldn't get an invariant action. So it's just a kind of empirical fact that the metric doesn't depend on any of these other gauge transformations. Doesn't transform. Sure.
Could you explain a little bit about why the curvature of vector bundle does not depend on the curvature of space-time manifold? Do you have any geometrical picture?
Why the curve? Oh, you mean why F doesn't depend on R? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, so the let's say that it's by construction in the way that I've constructed it, that you know, I have these two different independent vector bundles over space-time, the tangent bundle and a different vector bundle. And so they, because they're two independent vector bundles that just have a priori nothing to do with each other, their curvatures a priori have nothing to do with each other. However, you know, when you now build the full action for GR coupled to the standard model, and now you vary, you know, at the end of the day, you know, what we really have is an action for an action that where one of the terms in the action is the Einstein-Hilbert term, which is this guy on the left, proportional to R. And then there's all these other terms in the rest of the standard model, but to make the standard model live on curved space-time, to make it compatible with GR, you know, in this course, mostly to not confuse things too badly, we're going to deal with the standard model on flat space-time, and then I'll explain later, you know, how to make it generally covariant. It's very easy. You just in addition to making the covariant derivative d, you know, in addition to adding, instead of just adding a Christoffel symbol or just adding an a mu to make it covariant noble mu or covariant capital D mu, you just add both connections. And so now the covariant derivative is covariant with respect to both gauge transformations and coordinate transformations. And you replace, you know, the flat space metric eta mu nu by the curved space metric g mu nu. And for fermions, you replace the flat space tetrad by the curved space tetrad. Anyway, I haven't explained that yet. But but when you now take that full action and vary it with respect to the gauge field to get the analog of the Maxwell equation, you will get that the Maxwell equation will involve the curvature of space-time indirectly. But the definition of F still will not, because that's the definition of F as the curvature follows purely from the Ricci identity, the failure of the commutation of the two covariant derivatives. And that is just, that's not an equation of motion, that follows just from the logical construction of what the curvature means in terms of the vector bundles. And that, there, it's just, so the fact that the two vector bundles are completely independent identities, objects a priori, means that they have, that the definitions of the curvatures are a priori independent. Although again, the equations of motion, the Einstein equations and the Maxwell equations and their generalizations derived from the action that has all four of these symmetries, will couple those quantities together.
I have one more question. The dimension of the vector, what is the dimension of the vector bundle? Because you said that for the standard model, it will have 45 vectors, but basis vectors. So if that is true, does that contain the adjoint representation along with the other representations?
Good question. So this is something, it's probably going to be better to, it's going to be less confusing when I explain this. I mean, this is something that I'll be trying to explain starting in the next lecture, but just to quickly say, you know, so there's a logical splitting in just like there's a logical splitting in GR between two fundamentally different types of fields. There's the metric field and there's the connection field in the second order formalism. In Yang-Mills, there's also two types of fields. There is the gauge field, which is what we've been talking about in this lecture. And then there's the matter field, which is the section of this vector bundle V. And those transform into different representations of the gauge group. The gauge field transforms, we'll see in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. The matter field, the vector field, which is a section of the vector bundle V, transforms in some other representation, which is whatever we want. A priori, you can define a Yang-Mills field for any representation you want. That's something you just get to choose when you're deciding what Yang-Mills theory you want to study. And so observationally, a combination of observations and theory have taught us that the actual world we live in is described by a matter field, which is where the fermions transform in a 45-dimensional representation if there's no right-handed neutrinos, or a 48-dimensional representation if there are right-handed neutrinos. And that representation, and then there's also the scalar field, the Higgs field, which transforms in a different representation. But none of those matter representations are adjoint representations. It turns out that the matter fields, for some so far unexplained reason, this is one of the unexplained mysteries about the standard model, but for example, SU3 has an infinite number of representations, but an observed fact, which is not yet explained, is that the matter fields in the standard model all transform as either the singlet representation, in other words, they don't transform under SU3, or they transform as the fundamental representation, i.e. the three-dimensional representation of SU3. Nobody transforms as the adjoint, nobody transforms as any of the other infinite number of possibilities. For some reason, and that's true for SU2 and U1 too, for some reason, the matter fields in nature all either transform as the trivial representation or the fundamental representation of the corresponding gauge groups.
I have a question about the Einstein-Hilbert action. Why can't we build the action like Yang-Mills? I feel like we're constructing the indices in a different way in Einstein-Hilbert, right?
Yeah, that's a good question too. Yeah, so originally the way Hilbert found it was, both Einstein and Hilbert, what they wanted, so Einstein was looking for second order equations of motion. He wanted the equations of motion, the Einstein equations, to involve second time derivatives of the metric so that they would reduce to Newton's laws in the appropriate limit. And Hilbert had this different approach, which was more about looking for the simplest thing he could write down in the sense of something that was linear in the curvature. And then they realized basically that they had found the same theory in those two ways. But so nowadays you're absolutely right that you could take the Riemann tensor and you could construct other types of scalars, including a scalar which is more analogous to the one that we use for the Yang-Mills action. Those theories don't give rise to observationally correct and one thing that is wrong is that there is this theorem, there is Lovelock's theorem, which were one of the things Lovelock was this physicist. He was actually at the University of Waterloo in the 70s. He proved that there's only three terms you can write down built from the curvature tensor and the metric that, when you vary them, give rise to second order equations of motion. There's the term we wrote down. There's another term, which is the cosmological constant term. And then there's the so-called Lovelock term, which turns out to be a total derivative. So it doesn't contribute to the classical equations of motion. So the only terms you can write down that gives rise to second order equations of motion, if you set aside the Lovelock term, which only contributes quantum mechanically, is the cosmological constant term and the Einstein-Hilbert term. So that's sort of the modern explanation for why we only consider those two terms in GR, or those are the most important terms, let's say.
Okay.
But as we'll see later in the effective theory of general relativity and Yang-Mills, in effective field theory, you can add all sorts of more complicated terms that are also invariants, but are built by more and more powers of the field. But they are less important in effective field theory because they end up being, their coefficients have higher and higher inverse powers of mass. And if that's some big mass scale, that those terms end up being expected to be suppressed in terms of their physical effects. So that's another, the effective field theorist does include all these other terms which your line of thought would lead you to write down, but then understands them as being subdominant and in some cases so much so that we haven't detected their effects yet.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
One very quick question, maybe, and if not,
yes.
Like, would it be possible, like, to for all our GR quantities to add like a color index that is like continuous to take into account like the diffeomorphism symmetry, like write a gauge theory using that infinite dimensional group? Is that an approach that makes sense?
Yeah. So I think that story, that question is a very good question, doesn't have a simple answer. Some ways of trying to add gauge indices to the quantities in GR as a kind of hypothetical modified version of gravity, lead to conflicts with experiment and so are ruled out on that ground. But you can find ways to do it that make sense. And in particular, one of the approaches that people try in order to bridge the gap or unify GR with the other Yang-Mills theories, with the standard model or to combine GR with ordinary quantum field theory, is to try to rewrite it as a Yang-Mills theory where you take the gauge group to be, sometimes people try to take it to be the Lorentz group. So the Lorentz group SO3,1, which is normally a global symmetry group in special relativity. It's the kind of point isometry group of the Minkowski metric. They take that to be a local symmetry that acts above each point in space-time, and it's basically the Yang-Mills group G. And that approach, a puzzle you have to deal with there is that normally for Yang-Mills theories usually only make sense if the gauge group only has positive directions. If as I was saying before, like SUN, the vector space that it acts on, the inner product that it preserves, it's acting in an n component vector space where the inner product is those n complex numbers dotted with that, inner product. If you have a vector psi with n complex components, you take psi dag or psi to get the norm, and that's a purely positive quantity with no minus signs in the inner product. In GR, the corresponding inner product is the Minkowski inner product, which has 3 plus signs and 1 minus sign. And the consequence is that the gauge group is not compact. So it doesn't, the manifold is not a closed compact manifold. It's a kind of it's a non-compact infinite manifold. And a related fact is that some of the gauge fields end up having basically the wrong sign for their kinetic energy. They're so-called ghosts. So it tends to give rise to, let's say at first glance, it gives rise to a sick theory that has unstable fields with wrong sign kinetic terms, and which usually leads to non-unitarity when you quantize it. And so, but people have tried to devise ways around that. And I think that's a long, complicated, ongoing story. But that's definitely a direction that a lot of people have looked into over the years, and it's an interesting direction. And then people have done another thing, which is to take even the larger symmetry group of Minkowski space, the Poincaré group, which is not just the symmetries that preserve the origin, but the symmetries including translations that are isometries of Minkowski space, try to take that as the gauge group. And that's a whole other story that is related to this idea of Cartan geometry, which is a kind of generalization of Riemannian geometry. And anyway, beautiful topic. And people have also tried to formulate GR in those terms. And there's similarly are puzzles that, so I don't believe that there is a fully successful theory of that type, but there's definitely very intriguing and interesting, beautiful stuff that's been done in that direction. And maybe the last word hasn't been said. Yeah. All right. If there's no more questions, see you later. Thanks for all the questions.